Welcome to the January edition of Dog-Eared Reads. Hi, I'm Lori. I'm on the board of Kodiak Public Library Association, and it's my pleasure to bring you this month's Dog-Eared Reads, where we talk about good books, talk about what's going on at the Kodiak Public Library, and activities of the Library Association that you might want to get involved in. Throughout tonight's episodes, you'll be hearing cuts from the Allman Brothers instrumental piece called Jessica, which you can find at the Kodiak Public Library in its CD collection. Hope you enjoy a little bit of that music while you listen to this month's Dog-Eared Reads. On this edition of Dog-Eared Reads, we'll be talking to Harry Dodge about his writing. Harry is a local author who's lived in Kodiak for over 45 years and has published 3 books and is a well-known bear guide here on the island. We'll have a segment on poetry. That's in our Poetry Corner coming up with Tayton Sheridan and his wife Jennifer. This month at the Public Library, in addition to its normal story time and films and other activities, a new activity called The Ancestry Corner has been set up at the Public Library. You'll hear more about that today on Dog-Eared Reads when Katie Baxter comes in to talk to Kayla and me about this new program. It's also the time to get your altered book ready. Every year we have an altered book show that's held during the month of February at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. This collaboration between the Kodiak Arts Council and Kodiak Public Library Association has a new member this year, and that is the Kodiak High School Arts and Culture class, which is helping us put on this year's show. All artists should be working on their creations right now. Their work is due January 29th, 2018, by 4 o'clock p.m. to the Arts Council office. Kodiak Public Library Association and the Kodiak Arts Council are also sponsoring a workshop that will be held January 20th at Fisherman's Hall from 1 to 5 o'clock p.m., for a fee of $30. Please bring an old book and any supplies you wish to use. There will be additional supplies provided as well. Class size is restricted to 12 individuals, so get your name in pretty soon to education@kodiakarts.org and be a part of the fun for this year's Altered Book Show. Now let's talk about books. This month I'd like to welcome local author Harry Dodge, author of Kodiak Island and Its Bears, and The Hunts, and Kodiak Tales, Stories of an Adventure on Alaska's Emerald Island. Welcome, Harry.
Thank you.
Please tell us about yourself and how you came to Kodiak over 40 years ago.
Well, I came to Kodiak spring of 1975. I was living in Juneau at the time and had feelers out for fish and game jobs. I had a degree in biology, and that's why I came to Alaska to work in that field. And Ken Menthe called me up and sold me on a summer job in Kodiak. So I worked the summer out at Upper Station with Kelly Musin, who you know.
Yes.
And it was a great experience. And I really liked living in Juneau, but ended up going back there to get my stuff and moved to Kodiak.
You've had many interesting adventures, and I was interested, and I want you to tell the audience about that first time you met guides Bill Pinnell and Morris Tollefson and how that encounter may have changed your life.
Well, it definitely did. That first summer at Upper Station, when the Weir season was over and Fred Division, Fisher's Rehabilitation, they had a project where they were going to transplant adult red salmon from Upper Station to Akalura Lake. And so I stayed on for that. And long story short, the plane that we were transporting fish in, we had a really bad stretch of weather, got weathered in for several days, and it sort of broke, and Lonnie White was in charge of it. He slapped me on the shoulder and said, "You're next." So one guy had to go with the pilot to let the fish out. So I went on the flight, and the plane crashed into Akalura Lake.
Wow.
And sank. So I'd heard of Bill Pinnell and Morris Tollefson, but I'd never met them. Hal, the pilot, had hurt his back. He couldn't walk very fast, so he kind of gave me directions of how to find the cannery. And I'd taken my boots off and got rid of them to swim ashore. So wow. I was barefoot. Uh-huh. And it was about a 4-mile hike around the lake and to the cannery at Olga Bay. And so I met Bill, and he started telling me some bear stories and got the Calverts out. And he said, well, we might be needing a young guy this fall for packing, and nothing I would ever have dreamed of doing in a million years, but it sounded exciting, interesting, so I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up working for them for 17 years after that.
Well, I read that and I thought, wow, that's a long time plus a lot of work, mostly at the south end of the island, is that correct, where they had their camps?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting. Plus, you walked over there barefoot.
Yeah. I had a T-shirt on. I ripped that in half and made little booties to protect my feet.
Wow.
So I went totally barefoot.
Do you still guide bear hunters? I know you have a company called Kodiak Treks, but is it still bear hunting, or has your emphasis changed to wildlife viewing?
Well, I'm still guiding bear hunters. This next spring will be my final season of that.
Really?
We'll continue to do the summer wildlife viewing probably for a few more years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting life. In your book, Kodiak and Its Bears, there's an exhaustive history of Kodiak Island, not only bear hunting. I found it a very readable history, and it could be an important text for students who want to know more about Kodiak histories. I learned a lot about my husband's family and numerous bear guides are profiled in this book, and it provides an intriguing view of many adventurous men. And I wanted to know, what inspired you to research and write such a comprehensive work?
Well, I went to a low residency MFA program in Goddard College in Vermont. It was a 4-year deal. And finished my MFA and was just kind of kicking around looking for something to write. And I thought about maybe a history of bearing on Kodiak, and maybe the newspaper would be interested in doing a series on it. And they were. And I think I did a 3-part series devoted to the history of bear hunting. And in researching that, I could see that there is a lot more material here than I could ever do justice to, and the scope widened beyond just hunting to just people and bears sharing the island over thousands of years, and kind of highlighting a lot of the old timers that were guiding in the early days. And a lot of those old-timers families still are in Kodiak, and it's kind of a history of Kodiak, really.
It really is. It really added to my knowledge of Kodiak's history, as I used to teach it, but many stories in there are not in the general books about Kodiak, so it's quite interesting to me. And I note that you cited references from a great variety of resources, like the Holy Resurrection Church records, Kodiak Daily Mirror. You had 572 footnotes. You did a lot of research. How long did it take you to do all this, and did you have to travel to off-island locations to get the resources?
I did some visiting on the mainland. Also, my wife did a graduate program at UAA for 2 winters, and so we lived in Anchorage 2 winters, and that allowed me to go to the LUSAC and hang out there in the library at the university, which had all kinds of material. So I spent a lot of time in those libraries. At one point, I hired a researcher in Washington, D.C. to look up some things.
Mm-hmm. In the National Archives or
yeah,
something?
Uh-huh.
Wow. You interviewed many elders and many who have passed on, and I was wondering, was there a special or a favorite interview that you did, or one that you felt really touched your heart?
There were several that really struck me, but I think all in all, reading or meeting Roy Madsen was probably the highlight of the whole deal. I'd never met Roy before. Of course, I'd always heard of Judge Madsen, and he was so welcoming and forthright with material and pictures and stories, and he was very enthusiastic about it, and a lasting friendship developed out of that, and I really cherish that.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me, since we just said goodbye to him.
Yeah.
I was wondering, in this book, Kodiak and Its Bears, how long did it take you to complete the writing? And did you have to do many drafts? Did it take a long time or relatively?
Well, it seemed like a long time, but it was only 2 years, really. I found a publisher for it, and I really wanted to take a little longer. There are some loose ends in that, but he was on a hurry-up thing. And so the editing, he had a lady in Canada that did the editing, so it was all by correspondence, and this coincided with our summer season, so mm-hmm. I was trying to go over drafts while that was going on. It was not the smoothest process in the world.
I can imagine.
And there are a few oopsies in there. I would have liked to have taken another year. Since it's been published, I've got a stack like that of things that I found since then, and pictures, and so sometime I'd like to do a revised edition.
Well, I noticed it's had a second printing. Has it? It's been. Do you know how many copies have been printed?
5,000.
Wow, well, that's wonderful. Have you always been a writer, or have you developed this passion through the years?
No, I was a jock in high school.
Uh-huh.
I was real lazy when it came to English and that. It was always an easy subject, but I was never, my brother was a big reader, but I wasn't.
Oh.
When I was in the Army, and especially when I was in Vietnam, that really changed my way of thinking, opened up the world to me a little bit, and made me think a little deeper and look around me, and somehow from this, the desire to write evolved.
Oh, well. Have you been a journal keeper, or has it just certain things touched you and made you write about them? Or?
I never kept a journal until I went to Vietnam.
Oh, and then you kept.
I have loosely since then.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, in your second book, Kodiak Tales of Adventure on Alaska's Emerald Isle, you describe the many faceted experiences of living on Kodiak Island. And this book is a combination of short stories and 5 true stories about life on Kodiak. Do you prefer writing fiction over nonfiction, or do you not have any preference?
My preference is definitely fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's more difficult, and it seems a little less successful than the nonfiction I've written. I'm not sure why, but I like using my imagination, and I think that's where good art comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate the reality TV thing that's going on now. And I have friends that really won't read anything unless it's a true story.
Hmm.
If it's not true, it's not worth reading. And I think it's an unfortunate turn of events as far as literature goes.
Yes, it's nice to be able to use your imagination. And I notice in your third book, The Hunts, that is a fiction story.
Yes.
And one I have to admit I have not read, but is that based on experiences here in Kodiak?
Yes. It's based on my time at Olga Bay with Pennell and Tollison, Bill and Morris, and the two old men, and they're pretty accurate caricatures of those two guys. The cannery that's described in there is a very accurate description of the old Alaska Packer cannery at Olga Bay, and the events are fiction, but setting is pretty factual.
I look forward to reading it. Are you working on anything new?
I'm always working on something. There is a novella that was published earlier this year, Bridge 10, which is a Vietnam story.
Uh-huh.
And I'm always working on short stories and that, and sending them out to various magazines to try to get them published. There's one that's going to be published sometime this spring, I think. But.
Wow. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share with us today?
I just hope everybody's reading books, not watching television so much. And I think literature is a great way of expanding your mind and experience. And there's a lot of awesome writers out there.
Well, thank you very much. You're one of them, I think, and I'm very glad to have you come in today and be a part of our Dog-Eared Reads Beyond the Cover segment. Yeah, it's always nice to know that there's local people out there who are creating new work for us to read. And thank you for your time, Harry.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All of Harry's books can be found at the Kodiak Public Library, so check them out. You'll learn something new, I'm sure.
I'm Athenia Large, and I'd like to talk to you today about what our organization does. The KPLA provides support to the Kodiak Public Library through advocacy, outreach, and fundraising. Hopefully you've been out to one of our book sales. We hold them at the Kodiak Island Brewery, as well as every year during Crabfest, and always at the Kodiak Public Library, where we offer books for a steal of a deal. We've also sponsored movies that have been brought to the Kodiak Public Library, as well as authors such as Sandor Katz and Ray Troll. We worked hard to advocate to keep the OWL funding around last year, and just this year we started an endowment, so we're looking towards the future, providing even more for the Kodiak Public Library. Please check us out at www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org.
Thanks, Athenia. That's a great reminder. Also, it's time to apply for your permanent fund dividend here in Alaska if you're a resident, and you can designate a part of your dividend to go to local nonprofits, such as Kodiak Public Library Association, and we truly appreciate the support.
And you're listening to Dog-Eared Reads on KODK 90.7, Kodiak, Alaska. Dog-Eared Reads is a show for book lovers of all ages and airs the second Tuesday of each month at 9 p.m. Listen in or download the show at kmxt.org. And welcome to our new segment on Dog-Eared Reads, the Poetry Corner, where we'll share good poems, sometimes for the season and sometimes just because. Today, KPLA volunteer Jennifer shares a poem.
A poem by Emily Dickinson. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
And for those of you who like to go out on the water, here's this poem by John Masefield called Sea Fever. I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea in the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by, and the wheels kick and the wind's song and the white sails shaking, and a gray mist on the sea's face and a gray dawn breaking. I must go down to the seas again, for the call of the running tide is a wild call and a clear call that may not be denied. And all I ask is a windy day with the white clouds flying and the flung spray and the blown spume and the seagulls crying. I must go down to the seas again, to the vagrant gypsy life, to the gull's way and the whale's way where the wind's like a whetted knife. And all I ask is a merry yarn from a laughing fellow rover and a quiet sleep and a sweet dream when the long trick's over.
This month on our lively Lub Chat, we have a conversation with Kayla DeRoche and myself and Katie Baxter, director of the Kodiak Public Library, about a new tool and a new activity called their Ancestry Club. Currently on display in the public library right in front of the circulation desk are a lot of resources that they own on how to do research. When I looked in the catalog, there were over 30 items just in how to investigate your historical roots. Genealogy is a hot topic. Technology has made documents such as birth certificates, immigration papers, easily accessible. DNA testing kits are available to determine people's ethnic heritage and link them with living relatives. It's everywhere you turn. There's genealogical television shows. There's even genealogy cruises in the travel industry. It's especially popular in the United States because we have such an amalgamation of people from all around the world separated from their heritage and their roots, perhaps. And perhaps it's the baby boomers searching for their roots again. But it is something that has caught on. And in the interview today with Kayla and Katie, we talk about Ancestry.com. And I hope you'll enjoy this issue of Lively Lib Chats.
All right. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Could you introduce yourselves to the record, please?
Katie Baxter, Kodiak Public Library.
All right. And what do you do there?
I am the director.
Okay.
And I'm Lori Madsen on the Kodiak Public Library Association Board.
All right, great. So just to start off with, Lori, could you explain what the association does and what its relationship to the library is?
The mission of the Kodiak Public Library Association is to support the missions and programs and activities at the public library. We are strictly an advisory board, and we are there to help the library with whatever it might need. And we have an active organization. Our board consists of 9 members, and we try to be involved in as many activities the library has going on as possible and where they might need us.
All right. And so one of the programs you guys have made available is ancestral research. Could you talk a little bit about how you guys are getting involved in that?
We have provided the support for a subscription to Ancestry.com, which is an online research tool that will be made available to public library patrons.
When does it begin? When do you guys purchase the subscription?
We purchased it recently, and maybe Katie can talk about when that program starts.
Yes, the Ancestry Club was founded by members of the community who participated in the Scandinavian Culture and Film Festival Genealogy Workshop. And members of the community approached the library, and library staff have been very interested in genealogy and helping our patrons with those genealogy family trees and research tips. So this is a perfect time to start the Ancestry Club. We kicked it off in November. The next meeting is January 18th at 6 p.m. until 8:30 p.m. at the multipurpose room. And we'll be rolling out several of the library resources. Ancestry.com is one of those. And so it will be available as of January 18th. We're constructing a genealogy website page for our City of Kodiak Library website. So people will be able to access the library edition of Ancestry.com from the library. That is the one thing. Ancestry.com has been around since the 1990s. They have established a library edition of their site, and it is meant for the public to use, but it protects privacy, and that is why that particular library edition needs to be used within the library's actual 4 walls.
All right, and so how are the features different?
The features are different in that when an individual pays for his or her own subscription to Ancestry.com, they have ready access to their account from their home computer. But with the library edition, people are using their email accounts to funnel information, but they're able to access thousands and thousands and thousands of different types of vital records, as well as other passenger lists and digitized materials that Ancestry.com continues to add to its database. Plus, there are webinars that are available, training tools, and a nifty set of videos from experts in the field who share their stories and tips on how to uncover details about ancestors and build your family tree.
All right, so it's basically the same resources and database, but with more privacy assurances.
Yes, because many individuals cannot opt to purchase their own subscription to Ancestry.com. So again, since the 90s, libraries have been using Ancestry.com and making that tool available as part of a library package. And Ancestry.com was great about working with the library community and with the genealogists across the country and the National Archives, and they've been evolving this tool for decades.
Okay, and so the association is funding that?
We are paying for a year's subscription for this tool. And I was wondering, Katie, does the Ancestry.com search records internationally?
Yes, because they're growing that database, Lori. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Yes, they added just millions and millions of international records. And at one point, Germany released records to the vendor, and two other European countries did as well. So the interest in the common roots of the human community has just grown exponentially, really, since the 1990s. And Ancestry.com just keeps seeking more and more records. They offer scholarships, internships, funding towards the genealogy field and helping people create digitized records so that more people have access to those records.
That's great.
And so anyone can come to the library, no matter their genealogy. It's, I know that the motive started in that celebration we had earlier.
In the celebration, yes. Yeah. But the library serves all cultures and ethnic groups. And so, of course, our community is welcome to come. And January 18th is a nice time to get an overview and have a chance to try out the search tools. And we'll, as I said, introduce people to other tools as well. And it helps if you have your library card. You do need to have a library card to access the database. And we're looking forward to learning resources available, particularly for people of Filipino roots, because accessing some of those records can be a little tricky. However, access is broadening and getting more specialized. So it'll be fun over these next few years to see what genealogical studies with that particular culture and ethnic group unveils. That's going to be a lot of fun for us here in Kodiak.
Mm-hmm. As far as the workshops go, can you come in at whatever time and use Ancestry.com?
Yes, because it's available, it'll be available off of our City of Kodiak library website. And that's what we'll make clear as we create this webpage. And we'll have an announcement on the landing page so people will know how to access that tool. We're also creating a brochure in print and online that will summarize some of the basic steps to start your family history search. We have a couple of staff members. Ellie loves genealogy. She's really been digging in over the years and has learned a lot of tips and techniques. I've been involved with studying Irish genealogy for a little bit. I've been away from it since I've come to Kodiak, but it's fun getting back into it. And we have community members who are more than happy to share their strategies. Linda Kozak is one, Betty Odell. So we will be able to help patrons answer questions as well.
Can people bring their own laptops to access it in the building?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Because they will be logging in using the public internet connection, so the vendor will recognize that.
Oh, good.
But if there are any hiccups along the way, let us know, and we'll address those because we have a nice rapport with the vendor.
And so your ancestry is Irish?
Irish, Czechoslovakian, and French.
What's been your journey researching your ancestors?
I've had great fun starting with the stories of family members on the East Coast in Massachusetts who have been digging up material over the years, and they were very good about keeping their records using the family tree documents and also writing up the family stories. And that's something the library wants to help people do. Capture your information so that you can pass it on to a niece or a cousin in a very palpable way. And so that was exciting. That was motivating to me. And then I actually visited Ireland and went to their family research centers. And that was great because I met with people who were digging up archaeological material, and they were just at the point of digitizing that. So I was able to see some material that had not yet been released digitally to the rest of the world. So that's always fun to know how to use your digital tools, your great print resources, and then know when it's worth going to a country and sitting down and meeting with people. And my one regret in life is I was at the little town in Spittal in Ireland, and a bed and breakfast owner gave me a tip. He said, one of your relatives is, you go down the lane, over the bridge, it's the first house on the right with the red door. Wow. And he will give you your family history. And I was running out of time. I had to go catch the plane. So I never went and saw him. And I'm concerned he's passed by now. But that's the kind of, and I was like, what am I doing? Delay the flight.
Yeah, really.
Pay the money. But that's the fun. So
yeah,
it's a journey, it's a quest, and Linda Kozak explained that beautifully during the festival event, and we are just carrying on with that enthusiasm.
And I'm curious, I'm from the East Coast, and my dad's side of the family is French-Canadian, and they grew up in a small town in Massachusetts. Was that your Canadian side, or your French side, or were you more French than French-Canadian?
So more French than French-Canadian, to my knowledge. But see, once you start doing this kind of research, you begin to reveal more stories. So we're just starting to dig into the French side. That would be my father's mother. And we just don't have too much information about her. But I think she truly was French. But I won't be surprised if there was a Canadian route down to Massachusetts.
Right.
Interesting.
What about you, Laura? What's your ancestry? Have you explored?
I come from Scottish heritage. My grandparents were from Scotland, and they go way back, and we've tracked their heritage back to the 1500s, a little town called Maxey somethingville in southern Scotland, northern England. And my mother's side, that's my father's side of the family. My mother's side of the family was from Ohio. Predominantly, there's Dutch, maybe Eastern European Jew, and my grandfather says he was a cowboy born in Wyoming. So it's we have a little investigating to do on that side of the family. We've tracked the census records through the United States government's Census Bureau, but I'd be intrigued to use this Ancestry.com because it sounds like a really in-depth tool, and we'll learn things.
Why do you guys think that people are so fascinated by where their ancestors came from?
I think because people started to be curious about why they are like they are. and recognizing that everyone has a story. And I think too, as our elders who immigrated to this country have gotten older and eventually passed, the younger generations recognized they were losing people in their lives who were just treasures and people who had had crazy adventures. And those elders did not always feel comfortable sharing the details of their story because they were trying to make a better life for their family, or when they got to this country, they really had to go uphill sometimes to get their education, find their jobs. And they really did not want to remember. That's one thing I've learned. But then people of my age are like, well, wait a minute, there were stories there. It's part of me. And I'll tell you, my first trip to Ireland, I went when I was 10 years old, and then I went much later in life. And during my adult trip, I was like, oh, now I get it. I'm just like connected to these people. So I think that's a common thread, as I've conversed with others, that they're sorry they didn't learn more about family story when certain people in their lives were still with us.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with identity, because as Americans, many of us felt so homogenized, and where's our culture, and finding those roots can be satisfying to people and maybe explains their families, and like you say, people have passed on, and we want to hold on to that treasure.
Well, what other resources besides the Ancestry.com?
So, for example, in the suite of databases that are made available through funds from the Alaska State Library, we have always had access to the tool called Heritage Quest. So that's another tool we want to roll out. Ancestry.com has more information because that vendor has specialized in going after more digital information. Heritage Quest is a nice basic tool. It's easy to use, just may not be as powerful in the eyes of all users. We have a great little, it's a sweet book. I want to go back and study it a little bit more in our collection of the passenger lists on the ships from the Mayflower and other boats that came over to Virginia, Massachusetts, and some of those other East Coast locations. And then the State Library has a great genealogy website for anybody, and we want to promote that as well and make people available, because Alaskans certainly are interested about any cemetery records they can get their hands on. So you learn by going to that site how Juneau has handled gathering those records and some of our other Alaskan locations. And then that's gotten me thinking about what can we do in Kodiak to help get some of our cemetery information gathered and more accessible. That's a huge project. Mm-hmm. But we are realizing at the library that there's an increase in people wanting to have access to that kind of information. So that is what that's the kind of thing we'll talk about at the Ancestry Club. We'll explain that sometimes it feels like you're hitting a brick wall, and yet if you just keep track of that question and what you did up to that point, then revisit the question, because sources are always evolving and being worked on. So you don't want to ever feel like you're giving up. And I think that's the interest of the Kodiak folks in having this club. They want to keep motivating each other, encouraging each other, and sharing those tips.
So remind us again when Ancestry.com will be available to the public.
January 18th, though it is available now, we just haven't rolled out the easiest way to get to it, because we have to create the web page, mm-hmm. and we are working on that. And the Ancestry Club meeting will be Thursday, January 18th at 6 p.m. We understand some people will be showing up at 6:30 p.m. That is fine, because we'll be there till 8:30. So the Ancestry Corner is in the multipurpose room, and we look forward to having people come and share the successful results of their searches, their questions, their stumbling blocks, and their tips.
All right. And when did you guys officially purchase the subscription? Like when, what month?
Oh, January. So it'll January be for 1st. The year. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
All right. KPLA, the library really appreciates KPLA as a not-for-profit organization in our community with such a great focus on the library mission and wanting to provide support for programs, and Ancestry Club's a program, and this was just such a wonderful opportunity, and we're really thankful to KPLA.
All right.
You're very welcome. And we're happy to support the library. I think it's going to be fun, and I hope a lot of people come on Thursday, the 18th of January.
All right. Well, Katie and Lori, thank you so much for joining us. Well,
thank you, Kayla. And now for some book reviews.
This is a book review of The Blind Man and the Loon, The Story of a Tale by Craig Mishler, published in 2013. Craig Mishler offers a multidisciplinary approach to analyzing folklore literature, or ethnopoetics, as he calls it, as a modern form of culturally responsive literary criticism in his exploration of one traditional narrative, The Blind Man and the Loon. His book is of particular interest to academic scholars of cultural anthropology and indigenous literary studies, but it is equally appealing to the lay reader who enjoys learning about the deeper meaning within indigenous literature. Mishler is a folklorist and cultural anthropologist affiliated with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Native Language Center. He recently served as the editor of a collection of Gwich'in stories titled We Traveled from Place to Place, and is author of The Crooked Stovepipe, Athabascan Fiddle Music and Square Dancing in Northwest Alaska and Northwest Canada, which grew from his doctoral dissertation in 1981. After a career with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Mishler's writing is infused with metaphors relevant to the landscape and animal world from which the story emerged, making comparisons to the anatomy of fish, the evolution of birds, or the migration of caribou. He frequently weaves in scientific analogies for stories and storytelling, building connections to cartography, computer science, genetics, biology, and ecology, as he emphasizes the holistic perspective required for a Western audience to appreciate the depth of Indigenous knowledge and storytelling. His journey to explore the many versions of the blind man and the loon is both an academic and a personal one, as he strives to honor the storytellers who informed him and to understand the significance it holds for the people who tell it. He tracks the tale through Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and the Great Plains, and from within both Inuit and Athabascan or Nadine traditions. His catalog includes over 140 published and unpublished versions in print, audio, and film, as well as within over 50 works of art. Throughout the story of his research, he substantiates many important arguments about folklore collection and analysis. Rather than pursue a deconstructionist hunt for the elusive original tale, Mishler advocates for the development of a compendium of variants. As such, his methodology ensures a more unified and balanced experience of Indigenous knowledge and storytelling. Along the way, he also successfully debunks the popular superstition that writing down an oral narrative will kill it as it is transformed into a static form. Instead, he explores the story from both its oral tradition and written forms as he explains how the story itself is, quote, a vehicle for thought and reflection, a meditation on traditional values, beliefs, and behaviors, a tool for processing information, and a rich ethnographic database, end quote. He argues that when the written form follows a similar thoughtful approach, the essence of the story sustains its vibrancy. In Mitchler's own words, quote, part of the power of the story, The Blind Man and the Loon, is that it so vividly teaches the tragic consequences of violating these widespread but unstated norms subsumed in hunting rituals, incest taboo, child care, respect for the handicapped, and food sharing. When we hear the story or read it or see it, we are connected to that power, end quote. Embedded symbolism, gender and kinship tensions, and key value lessons all combine to teach about the right way to live within society and family. As he explains, quote, when these kinship obligations begin to disintegrate, as the story illustrates so vividly, the result is isolation, starvation, and tragic death, end quote. The beauty of a traditional narrative like The Blind Man and the Loon is how succinct and profound it can be as it teaches the, quote, importance of sharing food to bond families through kinship, the importance of maintaining subsistence hunting as a sacred way of life in the Arctic, the importance of respecting disabled or handicapped persons, and the importance of commemorating the beauty and transformative power of animals as spirit helpers, end quote. Mishler's holistic approach is further evident by his inclusion of a catalog of 54 pieces of artwork that also depict the tale. He is careful to explore the story not just in words, but as it appears in visual art and artifacts. He explains how in art, quote, one part of the story represents the whole. If you know the story, the visualization of one powerful scene or image invokes the entire narrative sequence, end quote. A major pitfall that he scrutinizes as he reviews the many variants of the tale is how frequently the actual speaker or performer from oral traditions are left nameless once put into writing. Eloquently describing the loss and cost of anonymity, he cites Bringhurst, quote, the result is that the real human beings who inhabit oral cultures disappear, and stereotypes replace them. Native American oral poets have so often been mistreated in this way that their namelessness has come to seem routine, end quote. In response, Mishler dedicates an entire chapter called The Tale Behind the Tale, where he provides photos and biographies of the oral poets who contributed their voice and version to early ethnographers. Mishler also takes a strong stance against the commercial processing of folklore for general public consumption. This is a deeply important message for amateur folklorists and literary writers who seek to mine the oral tradition, to retell or cleanse tales for public consumption. Too frequently, indigenous oral traditions are processed for Western media production into superficial, cleansed, or assimilated versions. These semi-literary variants are distilled for moralization, quote, antiseptically purged of the cruel betrayal and violent revenge motifs that are integral to nearly all of the oral variants, end quote. Mishler takes great care to explore what he outlines as, quote, layers of distortion, simplification, and loss, one from the process of linguistic translation, eliminating reporting speech, one from the process of semi-literary redaction, both expansion and abridgment, and still another from the process of editing and censorship, end quote. Ironically, he makes an honest point of adding that his book is a sign that mass mediation can also help sustain a powerful voice of a story through popularization. Mishler does more than analyze or reconstruct the context of the story for his readers. In essence, he creates a new life for the story through his careful collection and meditations on the many versions of the story, stringing them together like faceted beads. As such, he successfully avoids the dissection and fragmentation that so many previous generations of ethnographers have perpetuated. Instead, he contributes to the story's survival more than without his efforts, leaving it better than when he found it, a string of beads to explore as we meditate on meaning. My name is Alicia Drabeck, and that was a review of The Blind Man and the Loon, The Story of a Tale by Craig Mishler.
Thank you, Alicia. And another book review we'd like to replay is Bob Ross reviewing The Impossible Rescue, the true story of an Arctic adventure.
Hello and welcome to another in the series of book reviews from the archives of the Kodiak Public Library, Alaska Room. Deviating just a bit, in this month's book review, it comes not actually from the Alaska Room, but it will soon be there. But it comes from the juvenile section of the library. The book's name, The Impossible Rescue, The True Story of an Amazing Arctic Adventure by Martin W. Sandler. This 2012 softbound, easily read, and exceptionally well illustrated 163-page book is published by Candlewick Press. It is the successful rescue story of the Arctic whaling fleet trapped near Point Barrow in September of 1897. Now, they had felt that they had another 5 weeks of whaling time when cold weather came in and locked them in place. There were 8 boats that were trapped, 9 actually. The Alexander spent 18 hours both ramming forward and back and breaking a channel out to open water to escape the ice pack. It involved about 300 people trapped in the vicinity of Point Barrow. This is perhaps the greatest account that I have read of heroism, sacrifice, and endurance, both over land and sea, and it involves the revenue cutter, the Bear, and primarily 3 of its officers that formed what was later to be known as the Overland Relief Expedition. When the Alexander got back to its home port in San Francisco, they spread the word that the whaling fleet was trapped. Telegraph from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., alerted the president and his staff that there was potential for a mass starvation of the whaling fleet. They had provisions that would last them for a few months, but nowhere near what it would take to reach the spring thaw the following year. President William McKinley ordered the Bear to their rescue and relief. Captain Tuttle, in command of the Bear, was given full, carte blanche to loading the Bear with supplies and to head off in relief, but he was to travel as far north as he could before hitting the ice pack and then letting 3 of his officers off to make their way by foot to the relief of the people at Point Barrow. Captain Tuttle realized that he might not be able to get any closer than 1,500 miles, and we're talking about the dead of winter. The orders came down in mid-November of 1897. The orders as well stated that the overland route was to be taken by the three officers, and they were to link up with two different reindeer herders that were on the Seward Peninsula. There they were to convince these reindeer herders that they should relinquish their reindeer herd and accompany the revenue officers to Point Barrow so that the reindeer would then provide the food for the whalers. This, to me, is rather a interesting concept because there was no guarantee that the herders would agree with this plan. And so it all hinged upon the ability of the revenue cutters to convince these herders to do this task. And I think that's why we were calling this the impossible task. But even once they linked up, they still had 1,200 to 1,500 miles yet to travel to Point Barrow at temperatures which ranged as low as 60 below zero.
Right. So this is a pretty difficult, well, impossible journey. Not only are they sailing the boat, as far north as they can and then stopping, and from there heading overland to help, they have to somehow convince two different individuals to help them with this project by relinquishing their entire herd, helping to herd them over, and then providing food. And so, like, we talked about this a minute ago, Bob, and you mentioned that this whaling fleet of about 300 whalers was in serious peril, but it wasn't just the whalers now that were in peril because they were in the Point Barrow area. And what was the approximate population of Point Barrow at the time?
Well, at that time, actually, it was the Point Barrow station was a little over 100 people, mostly natives and a few whites that had a trading post, and there was one naturalist that was there collecting samples. Some of the buildings that were there were hardly usable. They had to cannibalize some of their buildings to make room for a portion of the whalers that would be needed to be housed there because some of the ships were crushed in the ice. Some of these ships were as far away as 65 miles from Point Barrow. It was too much for the community and for the fleet. It was just too much of a burden. Actually, the fleet was in danger of starvation, as was the people at the Barrow station.
Right. Once they tried to help, it tripled the size of the town they had, so all of a sudden their resources were scarce, and now the people living in Barrow were also at danger. So this is a very important mission, not just to save the whalers, but the people of Port Barrow as well. So in this book, it focuses on some of these main players.
Do you have a favorite, Bob, from when you read it?
I think each of the three officers and the two herders are probably the prime players in this particular book. But rather than detail how they went about solving this mission and the energies and the routes that they had to take to obtain it, just know that this was successful. Know as well that it should be common knowledge, yet for me, it was not, and possibly for you, it was not either. And one of the reasons for this is that upon the completion of their mission, it was buried in the newspapers because the Spanish-American War had just broken out, and everything at that point was directed to the new war effort. The thing I liked as well about this book, besides the fascinating read, and the tremendous photographs that were taken by Dr. McCall, who was the physician and also the cook for this expedition, was that at the end of the book, it gives you kind of a Paul Harvey, and now for the rest of the story, it takes your cast of characters and it gives you a breakout of what these people did for the balance of their careers. It also takes the revenue cutter Bear and gives you its history. The revenue cutter Bear is, of course, important to the Kodiak area as well, especially around 1913 when we were covered in ash. Ellsworth Bertholdt was one of the three officers that were put ashore. He later became the first commandant of the Coast Guard and was the prime fighter among the other services to keep the Coast Guard as a separate entity from the Navy or the Marine Corps, where political factions wish to put it. I found this book to be, perhaps, if I were to read only one book on Alaska this year, this would be the book. And to find it in the juvenile section is an amazing thing, because the book does say it's for ages 10 and up, but I didn't get it when I was in school, and I should have, and so should you have. This is just fascinating Alaska history.
And just because of a quirk of fate, it got buried historically behind the war. That's fascinating. So tell us a little bit about the future of one of these characters.
Let's talk about the bear itself, because I find the bear to be just a fascinating study. In this chapter of the book, and this starts on page 135 of the book, what happened to them? And it has the bear. From the time that it brought the rescue whalemen back to Seattle until well into the 1900s, the bear continued to patrol Alaska waters, providing aid to mariners and to people living along the coast. When it was put into dry dock in the late 1920s, it appeared that the ship's days at sea were finally over. But destiny still had many new adventures in store for the bear. Purchased by famed explorer Admiral Richard Byrd, the bear carried the Byrd and his party to two historic trips to Antarctic, first in 1933, 34, and then in 1939 to 41. When the United States entered World War II in 1941, the bear was again passed into service patrolling the waters off Greenland and Iceland. Soon after the war ended in 1945, the ship was dry docked once again, this time in Halifax, Nova Scotia. But in 1963, she was purchased by a businessman from Philadelphia who intended to turn her into a floating restaurant. Almost as if in protest of such a degrading ending to such a proud and historic past, the bear's old seams opened up while she was being towed to Philadelphia, and the 89-year-old vessel sunk in 300 feet of water. Despite lengthy underwater search, headed by the man who had discovered the remains of the famous Civil War ironclad, the Monitor, the bear was never found. She still lies in that watery grave. Former Dean of the Coast Guard Academy, David Sandler, has stated, perhaps a fitting place for one so grand a seagoing history.
Very interesting, Bob. I always like it that you pick out books that adults might not look for because they're in the juvenile or the young adult section. Check it out on the library's catalog, which is available online at www.city.kodiak.ak.us/library, and search the catalog for things you might be interested in about Alaskan history. Well, that wraps up another edition of Dog-Eared Reads, sponsored by the Kodiak Public Library Association. If you'd like to get involved with our radio program, give us an email, kpla.alaska@gmail.com, and be listening next month on the second Tuesday at 9 o'clock p.m. on KODK. And streaming live on the web at kmxt.org, your public radio station. Thanks so much, KMXT, for allowing us to broadcast this show.